We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Every month we chat with the director of UWM's Manfred Olson Planetarium, Gene Creighton. We've talked about everything astronomical, from viewing constellations to what it takes to land on a comet to exoplanets.
This past Monday, we took the conversation out of the studio and into the planetarium itself and did our usual monthly chat in front of an audience of WUWM listeners. We recorded the entire evening, and the following is an excerpt from that recording.
Gene, just to start, because you reminded me how this got going, I did not remember how we first started doing this, and it's been about 7 years.
It started when Mitch Tyke came to one of my Sunday afternoon programs, and he came up to me and he said, "Would you be interested in doing this on the radio?" And I thought to myself, "Sure, I'd be happy to give it a try." And we started with Bonnie. I only think I've recorded with Mitch maybe once or twice
when
you've been sick or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we hit it right off, and we started at first, you know, a little tentatively. We didn't know each other, so we kind of said, "Well, what are you going to say? We had a very detailed plan. Now we've done it so many times, I show up, it's like, "What are we talking about?" I give her an idea, "Oh, okay, great, let's go with that."
And sometimes I'll be jotting notes in the studio and I'll say, "Okay, should I ask you about this?" And she'll go, "Oh, no, ask this instead." It's like, okay. And so my idea is to come at it from absolutely a layperson's perspective, somebody who's interested in astronomy, somebody who loves to look at the night sky and is fascinated with astrophysics, but has no math background, has no real science background, is just curious. And so, you know, I try to be a stand-in for any of you who are in that position. I mean, for folks who have the background, it's probably pretty low level. But, you know, for people who might be interested and don't think they have a way into astronomy or into cosmology, that's kind of the idea behind doing these. And we just started calling them Astro Chats, and that's kind of stuck. And so, you know, we've tried to do some really interesting, you know, very, like, what do you see in the night sky this time of year, all the way to, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, what it was like to fly in the stratosphere. Because Gene got to, was it the stratosphere? Yeah, Gene got to do that on the SOFIA mission, and I want you to tell them about that, because that was pretty fantastic.
It was pretty fantastic. So NASA chose me last year to be one of the 24 Airborne Astronomy Ambassadors. So SOFIA is the largest moving astronomical observatory. The telescope is 100 inches across, and it's in a modified 747, that has the peculiar feature of the door being open when it's in the air. Normally, this is frowned upon, but it's designed, the whole airplane has been reconfigured so that when you open at altitude the door, the telescope can look out. And we were particularly interested in both really young stars and kind of middle-aged stars. So those were the two things we were looking at. And it was an amazing experience. The telescope is an infrared telescope, which means that it can see parts of the sky that with a regular, I'll call it regular telescope, an optical telescope, you simply cannot see. It's invisible. So if you look at Orion, for example, with a regular telescope, you see stars, of course, a bunch of stars. And if you have a strong telescope, you see more stars. But with an infrared telescope, you see stars, but that's the icing on the cake. The cake is huge clouds of gas and dust. So if you want to understand more about the universe, you want to look at multiple wavelengths so that you can fill in the story, as it were. So it was an incredible experience. I spent 20 hours in the stratosphere at 45,000 feet. Now, I don't want to be accused of false advertising. 45,000 feet is not high enough to be weightless. You don't need any kind of astronaut suit. But it is high enough that if the airplane were to depressurize, then we would all faint within a few seconds. So you do require a personalized oxygen setup that you have on your person while you're wandering around and looking at the equipment and talking with the other people there.
Since you're looking at infrared in that particular telescope, what were you actually seeing? Or were you looking at numbers? Were you actually looking through it out into the universe?
telescopes that are that big, but you can never just go to the eyepiece and look through them. They're always connected to some computer terminal. And that came from the days when the telescope was in some cold, danky room, and you don't necessarily want to be in that very cold room. You want to be in a nice heated room with lots of lights so you can do your work. So this telescope was sitting at 70 degrees below zero. The stratosphere is cold. So we were very grateful that we were on the other side of the wall. Because many of the objects we were looking at were bright, we could see individual stars on the screen. This wasn't necessarily always true. If the object is dim enough, then the instantaneous image that you get doesn't show you very much. To see the objects clearly, you need to stack multiple images one on top of the other, integrate them together, and then you get something bright. But some of the objects were really bright, so even the instantaneous image you could tell where are the stars.
Well, I want to move on maybe outward a little bit, and we want to talk about Pluto, because we have to talk about Pluto. Have people been looking at the photos that have been coming back? Are they not spectacular? Although I have to say the thing that made me laugh was the one that showed the Death Star. It's like the close-up of Pluto. They've discovered what it really is, and it was the Death Star, but obviously that's not true.
Obviously.
No.
But let's just say that Charon has an area that's designated as Mordor, which I think is fun. These, of course, are at this point definitely unofficial naming schemes, and you can be sure that the final names will be different, I imagine, unless they decide that they're going for a Lord of the Rings theme, which, of course, my boys would be very pleased with. So the first images that came through that I kind of got on my radar screen were images that showed a lot of detail on the surface of Pluto that was different than I expected. I'm no Pluto expert, to be sure, but I thought that what we would see for Pluto would be more similar to what we saw with Charon, its largest moon, i.e. similar to the moon, our moon. Lots of craters, an old kind of steady environment. It looks, though, that Pluto has a more recent surface, features that indicate this surface is newer and more intriguing, much more intriguing than I think anybody expected.
Do we think that Pluto might get reinstated as a planet? I know a lot of people were very disappointed when it got demoted.
Thank you for asking me that. Because I guess this is where sometimes there is a disconnect between what's happening in the scientific community and what the rest of the world is thinking. When Pluto changed its status, people would come up to me and say, my first grade teacher told me that Pluto is a planet, and they felt strongly that this should be forevermore how it is. From a scientific point of view, though, this is a problematic way of thinking, because our first grade teacher and anybody in 1930 when Pluto was first discovered, this is the best that we could do. This is the information that we had. Should we not be allowed to change our mind in the face of new information? So the other piece of information that I'd like to pass on about the change of Pluto status is this has happened before, and some of you might know this. But in the early 1800s, every other year, somebody was finding a new planet. They were small, but still visible. A couple of them were visible with not too big a telescope. And then they found 3 and 4 and 5 and so on. The planet count got to be 18 before people said, you know what? There are thousands of these. They cannot be. All these little floating rocks can't be planets. These are asteroids. So this has happened before. Pluto was the first Kuiper Belt object discovered. Is it possible that its status changes again to a planet? I don't want to commit. I think it would be a mistake given how many objects like Pluto we found in the Kuiper Belt. We have found over 1,000 at this point. Pluto is big. Ceres is big in the asteroids, but it's a whole class of objects. think Pluto as well with his brothers and sisters that we have found. Does that make sense?
And does everyone know what the Kuiper Belt is? Does anyone not know what that is?
Kuiper Belts, yes. So thank you for asking. See, she's a good representative for a good spokesperson. Kuiper Belt is a donut, if you will, of icy, rocky materials that Gerard Kuiper predicted in 1950. And he thought such a thing should exist, because there's a certain class of comets, they're called short-period comets, that come to the Earth very often, when I say very often, under 200 years, and they seem to come from the same height, if you will, from the sky. They seem to come from a fairly isolated part of the sky, whereas long-period comets can come from all kinds of directions, and their periods tend to be thousands of years as opposed to a couple hundred. So Kuiper said, you know what, I think that if we look out for these frozen objects, that as they approach the sun, they develop these beautiful long tails, we will be able to find them. It took, if we don't count Pluto, which we should, but he didn't realize that, the next Kuiper Belt object was in 1992. So it took 40 years before we found the next Kuiper Belt object. And as I said, now the count is a little over 1,000.
In that 40 years, so much else happened in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And for you, what has been the most exciting thing in terms of discovery in your career, during your, I'm just going to narrow it to your career time. So starting maybe with a grad student moving forward.
Well, that'd be really hard because can I go for two?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So when I was a graduate student, a major technological advancement happened, big time. And that was that we sent satellites traveling around the Earth looking in the microwave part of the spectrum. So in my lifetime, we went from let's talk about cosmology from a philosophical point of view, from a mathematical point of view. I mean, a lot of exciting things, but the models were models based on mathematics and what's aesthetically pleasing and other things like that. We didn't have any data, or not enough. In my lifetime, we have now images of the universe that tell us details about the whole history of the universe, starting from when the universe was only 400,000 years old. So it is experimental science now. And it's not just I say this and you say that and we go have a beer and argue over it, or coffee. It's, well, does your theory explain the data? Is it consistent with what we see? That, I think, has been great, to have cosmology, which is so exciting fundamentally, to be able to tell the story, the whole history of the universe from almost the beginning to now, and to foresee the future based on data and not just hearsay. The other development, I guess, that I think was a surprise is that we have found planets around other stars. If you had asked me when I was a graduate student, which is now almost 25 years ago now, that's not true, sorry, I don't know, less than that, but let's say 20, that some people at that point in time were looking for planets around other stars and that they were improving the machines that could do that by a factor of 1,000, I don't think I would have believed you. Exoplanets at the time was considered pretty out there, pretty risky. And some people staked their entire careers to find planets around other stars, and now the count is over 4,000.
And there was that new one that they are just talking about.
And we're finding planets that could be like Earth all the time now, to the point where an astronomer says, Earth 2.0, yep, another one. There are lots. There are over 300 planets that could be like the Earth. I'd have a hard time discriminating between those two because there's elegance. To me, the big universe is very elegant, and to try and figure it out is why I'm here. But there's also a piece of me who's so interested in the possibility of life elsewhere. And I think a lot of people connect with that. So those would be my top choices.
And the other part of that, and we have talked about this in different ways over these 7 years we've been having these conversations, it would be so wonderful if we could get there. I mean, that's Star Trek. Those of us who grew up on Star Trek, going out to explore the universe with the idea that you have a hyperdrive or you have some way of shortening those immense distances, which we don't have yet. And to me, I would still, there's still a part of me that fantasizes about, wouldn't it be amazing if we could actually get to one of those planets and see for ourselves?
We're a ways from that.
Yeah. It would take many lifetimes, I think, wouldn't it, to
get
to,
I think the best we can do right now is communicate with the speed of light, and that is sending our little messages that we're here and listening to see whether anybody is trying to communicate with us. At this point, that's by far and away our best bet.
How far away do you think we are for, like, interstellar travel of any kind? Like, let's say Mars. That's not really interstellar, but, you know, interplanetary in this case.
Well, those are two very different things, of course. So the claim is that NASA is aiming to send people to Mars in the mid-30s, so around 2035 or so. Given that most of these things take longer than anticipated, I think it's going to be probably 2040. And there are many technical things that we need to solve to figure out before this can happen. But a couple of big milestones have been addressed. One of them is that the radiation on Mars isn't so incredibly high that it would kill you too quickly. I mean, you do get an increased, obviously increased radiation dosage, but I believe the measurement now suggested that it increases your chances for cancer by 5%. Considering how many other dangerous things you will need to do to get to Mars, it's considered an acceptable risk. And of course, some people are just willing to do it. The other piece is that we seem to have a large amount of frozen water on Mars at the ready, which is great, because if we couldn't use the water there, then the game was over, because there's no way that we would spend the money to carry all the water that we would need, too expensive. So those were two important things that we have sorted out.
But we still haven't figured out the weightlessness issue. There are medical issues.
There are medical issues. Yep. Physical and psychological, but the real issue is the technology at the moment does not exist for us to send a group of people to Mars and then have them come back, because you need a lot of fuel to leave Mars, obviously less than you do to leave Earth, because the pull that the gravitational field of the Earth has is stronger. But even from Mars, you are going to need to use some fuel to get back, and it's just hard.
Right
now,
it's a one-way trip. If we did it at all, it would be
yes. And NASA doesn't do one-way trips, at least not on purpose.
Like Effect Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She joins us each month to chat about all things astronomical.
This month's conversation was recorded at the planetarium in front of an audience of Milwaukee Public Radio listeners. Thanks to WUWM's John Strelecki, Christine Lamatina, and Michelle Maternowski for their help in making the entire evening a success. Thank you.